Sunday. Sunday morning begins peacefully. The Brazilian music, the toasting bread, the sunlight streaming in. The breakfast ritual unfurls smoothly. I don't know why, but I feel a particular tenderness for my children when they come down in their pajamas. My children ask me if I slept well, and I wonder if that shouldn't be the other way around. And then my husband whispers those fateful words in my ear.
We need to find a moment to talk. It's important.
It is a small mercy that I have mastered a facade of cold, unfeeling beauty that allows me to seem unfazed. I take another sip of coffee to catch my breath. I'm sure my heart skipped a beat. I read a very serious article on broken heart syndrome. The Japanese have a word for it, takotsubo. In France, doctors call it sidération myocardique, myocardial stunning. The heart stops due to intense sadness, then starts again. So I know that dying of heartbreak is not just for heroines of 17th century novels. Discreetly, I move my hand to my chest. I feel the contraction of my heart behind my sternum, the valves and ventricles shut momentarily. Everything is fine. My husband uttered that murderous phrase while leaning toward me, his hand on my lower back. Why did he put his hand on me? To ease the shock of the announcement with physical contact? Or is it a way of showing that what he has to say is important but not bad? That we have to find a moment to speak but I have no reason to worry? Or is he trying to act like everything's fine in front of the kids? Did he whisper those words to me in front of them because he was afraid of my reaction? It's cowardly to use them as a shield. My husband resumes the conversation as though nothing happened. When he's finished with his coffee, he goes upstairs to take a shower while I stay seated at the breakfast table. I search for a green object nearby, anything at all in my field of vision that can assure me I have nothing to worry about. But I find nothing. My gaze stops at the kitchen clock, which is peacock blue. Maybe I could call it dark green. My children are talking to me, but I can't understand what they're saying. They seem to be speaking a distant and incomprehensible language that I can't decipher. Finally, I hear them ask,
Mamo? Are you okay, Mamo?
I wish I could tell them no, that I'm not okay, that my husband is going to leave me tonight. Or I could say it in a way that would impress the urgency upon them. Your father is going to leave me tonight, do you understand? We'll tell you next week after dinner. Probably Wednesday night, when we've had the time to choose the right words and the right moment. We'll all be seated around this very table. My husband will get up to turn off the music, and then he'll come back, place a solemn hand on my shoulder, and sit down next to me. He'll be the one to speak first.
Kids, your mother and I have something important to tell you.
He'll have a very adult way of phrasing things. He'll remind you that we love you very much and that our separation won't change that. He'll tell you that it's not your fault and that despite everything, we'll remain a family. This scene that I visualize effortlessly, I've imagined it so many times, unexpectedly puts me at ease. For all this time, I haven't been crazy after all. My anxiety was founded, my fear legitimate all along. I had every reason in the world to be worried. My husband really did intend to leave me. But this isn't my greatest fear. Yes, I'm afraid that he'll leave, that he'll ask for a divorce, that he'll cheat on me, that he's still enamored with his first love, that he'll fall for a coworker, that he'll come out as gay, that he'll lose all passion for me. The list of my fears is long, but there is one dizzying fear that surpasses all the rest. My greatest fear is that one day people will say about us, that man spent 35 years with a woman who wasn't the one. The pain is relentless, an octopus that wraps around my neck and squeezes. Everything hurts and I can't hear anymore, but I am relieved. By leaving me, my husband is rectifying the situation, correcting course. He always makes good decisions, and he's often right, on his reading of Proust, on the best route to avoid traffic,
on his geopolitical analyses of the Middle East. I have a blind confidence in his judgment. He's a good man and an excellent father. If he's leaving, it's because it's the right thing to do and the right moment to do it. I just have to let it happen. I don't need to stress or try to do anything about it. I can close my eyes, succumb, let him handle the situation. My husband knows what he is doing. My relief mitigates my pain. It's the relief that comes when what we've been dreading finally happens. When we're playing hide and seek and our hiding place is discovered. When a loved one we cared for deeply, who's been sick for a long time, passes away. When the main character of a horror movie is caught by the monster who's been hunting them. It's a good thing. I have nothing left to fear, because what was bound to happen has happened. I have nothing left to fear, because the worst has happened. I've been afraid that my husband was dying to divorce me but didn't have the courage to act on it. The more time passed, the less his presence in our bed each night assured me that he really wanted to be there. I knew that our marriage, our two kids, and our house forced him to be there with me. Paradoxically, I was more confident when we had just met. His love for me was purer then because nothing kept him by my side. Today, I wish I could yell it from the mountaintops, tell it to all the women expecting marriage to be the ultimate proof of love. Marriage guarantees nothing, except that he won't tell you he's cheated with a coworker because he'll have too much to lose. Having children with the man you love is even worse. Now he's forced to be with you for years, even once desire has fizzled out. When we have a boyfriend or girlfriend in kindergarten, the entire relationship plays out during recess. In middle school, it's a week. Monday, you're together, and by the last class on Friday, it's over. In high school, maybe it's a month or two. You fall in love in September, everything is over by Halloween. Already, the time before the breakup has gotten longer. In your 20s, separation can take an entire year, but if one of you lacks the courage, you can add 2 years more to the count. After 40, it takes at least 10 years to separate. 10 years between the moment you realize it's not working anymore and the moment you decide to leave. Luckily, my husband is not a coward. I've always admired his frankness, even if it no longer works in my favor. My husband is undeniably wonderful in that way. He won't put off what's right in front of him for another few years. He'll leave me abruptly from one day to the next. This morning we woke up married, tomorrow we'll wake up separated. I feel sick at the idea that soon his mouth will be off limits to me, that I'll no longer have the right to kiss him, that I won't be able to refer to him as my husband. It's easy to identify a first time, but we rarely know when something is happening for the last time. How could I have guessed that it was our last carefree Monday, the last dinner with our friends, the last time he would make love to me? If I had known, I would have imprinted in my body's memory each of his thrusts, his breath on my neck, the way he turned me over on the mattress. And on a larger scale, how could I have foreseen that it would be our last Christmas, the last of our daughter's birthdays celebrated together, our last vacation? If we could identify our last times as easily as our first times, thousands of moments would be lived more intensely. It's over. My marriage is crumbling, a failure. A breakup always is. Even so, I don't know whether I regret having chosen this relationship. Because at some point, we all have a decision to make, choose to love or to be loved. There is no couple where love is shared equally. It's not possible. So we have to determine which kind of romantic life we'd like to lead. Will we be the one who receives or the one who gives? Before meeting my husband, I lived several love stories. I was always loving desperately and intensely. There was only one exception, Adrien. For the first time in my life, I was with a man who loved me more than I loved him. 2 years with Adrien, going to sleep before him every night. 2 years with no sadness, but also with no passion. With my husband, I knew immediately that it would be the inverse, that the power dynamic would be to his advantage. So I hesitated. I even left him a few months into our relationship to give Adrien another chance. 2 weeks of wavering, lulled by the sound of the waves. But in the end, I chose my husband. Loving more seemed the more noble choice, and my attraction for him was so intense that I wondered sincerely what I would do if I couldn't see him every day for the rest of my life. His way of speaking, of walking through a room, of moving his hands, everything about him immediately overwhelmed me. Breathing the same air as him, sharing his bed, going on vacation with him, it was all a privilege that I couldn't turn down. Maybe my husband's charisma skewed my judgment. In any case, I left Adrien on the seaside, I renounced the comfort of being loved, and I went back to my husband for good. Today, I don't know if I regret my choice, but I see that I paid a high price, much higher than I had anticipated. If I had chosen to be loved rather than to love, I would certainly have been a better mother, and I would have had the necessary headspace to form real friendships and focus on my career. But why leave me this year? Why leave me in the spring? Why leave me today? Sunday is a strategic choice because it's indisputably a white day. If the other day's colors are more difficult to decide on, Sunday is unanimously white. Of course, it's a sacred white. It's also a universal promise of peace. My husband can be assured that our separation will be peaceful. And he put on Brazilian music, which is what he listens to when he's calm and serene. So he is not tortured by his decision. He is sure of himself and will not go back on it. Everything will go smoothly. But the white of Sunday is not as simple as it seems. Optics teaches us that white is the result of a combination of every color, and not the absence of color, as I once thought. It's not the purity of the bride or the emptiness of the blank page. Sunday is neither neutral nor naive. White is the synthesis of every color, just as Sunday is the synthesis of every day of the week. It's the final result, the last chapter, the solution. My daughter sits at the piano. My son takes out his clarinet. They're practicing for the year-end concert at the conservatory. It's in 3 weeks, and I already know the piece by heart. Imagine a long, sorrowful moan, or a 4-year-old child whining for 7 minutes straight. Poulenc is rarely festive, but this piano-clarinet duo is particularly dreadful. If I hear it one more time, it will sap the last of my remaining strength. I'll go wash my hair to drown it out. I stare at my reflection for a long time in the bathroom mirror. I don't recognize myself. Perhaps a shower will help me feel back to normal. I make the water colder and colder, turning the faucet until the frozen stream leaves a painful mark on my body. The cold anesthetizes me. It helps me submit to the white of Sunday. Particles of dust float through the air. I glimpse them in a ray of sun. My moisturizer is an immaculate white when I place a dollop on my hand. I hadn't noticed this brilliant white the other days of the week. The milk in the children's bowls also stood out with a particular gleam over breakfast. And of course, I chose a white silk shirt. As I was standing in my underwear in front of the dresser, suddenly white appeared as the most comforting color and the only one I could reasonably wear to get through this day. White helps, but it doesn't stifle the questions racing through my mind. I learned not long ago that there are two ways of thinking. Some people think in a long interior monologue with full sentences, while others reflect through abstract concepts. I belong to the first category, along with nearly 60% of the population. So in my head, I ask myself, why now? Why this morning? Why today? Did my husband stop loving me a long time ago, but want to wait for the kids to be a certain age before telling me? Did he think that divorcing before the summer would be a good idea? This way we can move before summer vacation, and the kids won't have to change schools during the year. Even so, I am astonished that he would leave me in June. The statistics on this subject are clear. Divorces are more frequent after vacation than before, at the end of the summer and after Christmas. These facts are circled in red in my notebook of romantic tips. For years, sociologists and economists have observed that the divorce rate is not correlated to a rise in unemployment or the real estate market. On the other hand, at the end of each holiday, divorces systematically increase. According to the latest data, the risk of divorce increases after 5 years of marriage. It makes no sense. We've been married for 13 years. Maybe it's because of that unlucky number. With our separation in June and after 13 years of marriage, we will be the exception that proves the rule. But there must be a reason why my husband is leaving me now. Did he see me on Thursday with Maxime? Did he catch me and Pierre yesterday? Did he meet someone else? Come to think of it, now it seems obvious. The plane tickets to Venice weren't for me. We've never gone together. We have no memories there. It's the ideal place to begin a new romance. He'll discover Doge's palace with his new partner. He'll tell her that he loves her for the first time in front of St. Mark's Basilica, and they'll make love for hours in their hotel room with a view of the Grand Canal. While I'm fastening my earrings, gold hoops given to me by my husband that I'll no longer be able to wear without crying, the truth appears to me suddenly, simple and chilling. My husband has no idea about Maxime or Pierre. He hasn't met anyone else. The tickets for Venice were for me. He's going to leave me because he found the notebook of punishments I've kept scrupulously for the last 2 years. He must have come upon it while moving books around in the library. When he opened it, he would have been shocked to discover its contents, with my comments in the margins. This notebook is nothing like a diary. No long, pathetic complaints, like Phaedra, I hate pouring my heart out. No psychological analyses. Instead, there are three columns drawn with a ruler. Offense, punishment, date. On the first pages of the notebook, I establish the most frequent offenses and the corresponding punishments. For example, forgetting to wish me good night before going to bed means no cuddles the next morning. Similarly, staring for a long time or repeatedly at his phone on the living room sofa when I'm sitting right next to him, even if the TV is on, incurs the following punishment: not picking up the next time he calls, and not calling back until he's called at least twice. These are two punishments that I had to enforce at the beginning of this week, with the aim of reestablishing equilibrium between my husband's behavior and my own. That's the very principle of restorative justice, and I know from experience how important it is to be in a relationship with a baseline of equality. To avoid arbitrariness, I opted for a codified system. For each romantic offense, there is a punishment. It's as simple as that. My 9-year-old son learned in the first trimester of school that arbitrary power is an authority limited by no rule, exercised according to the will of a sovereign. It's out of the question for me to act on a whim or change my mind from one day to another, to be angry at my husband on Monday and tell myself that it wasn't that bad on Tuesday. The rules exist for a reason. They are always the same, and they must be followed. When I enforce a punishment, I ignore the particular case or the extenuating circumstances. I don't seek excuses for my husband. I simply take the facts and obey the consequences. Whether he's tired, stressed, or sick, the same code applies. In court, the judge doesn't ask whether the accused comes from a modest family or whether he was having a bad day. For each crime, there is a punishment. The fact that my husband's mother didn't hold him in her arms enough when he was little, or that he had a difficult work week, must not be taken into consideration. It's hard, but it's the rule. A crime, a punishment, 365 days a year. That's the foundation of our modern criminal justice system, and it has proven its worth. Why shouldn't we apply it to the private sphere? Laws regulate our behavior and allow us to live together in society, It should be the same for domestic life. My husband knows that he must wish me good night every night, that he owes me respect and loyalty. There are weeks when I don't have to take out my notebook from its hiding place in the library. Weeks without punishment exist. It is possible. This system is by no means cruel, quite the contrary. Its primary goal is to simplify my life. It limits the number of questions I have to ask myself each day. When my husband hurts me, whether his betrayal is serious, the Clementine incident, or trivial, looking at his phone on the sofa, I know what I have to do. Apply the corresponding punishment. I write down the offense with a ballpoint pen, and the solution appears to me. It limits my nights of anxiety, the wounds that fester and never heal, because from the moment my husband is punished, I feel that he's paid his debt, and then I can start to forgive him. New crimes make a regular appearance in my notebook. Despite the years, my husband still finds new ways to torture me. But sometimes it's also that it takes me some time to gauge the level of the injustices I endure. For example, the closed shutters in our bedroom every night. I never thought my husband should be punished for it, that his need to sleep in total darkness constituted an infraction. But my frustration began to grow, to take up more and more space, until my tears of rage erupted last night. I still haven't found the punishment capable of reestablishing balance, of making amends for my 40,000 hours of destructive sleep in the dark. Finding a punishment proportional to the transgression is the most difficult part. I can't be too severe. I won't push him out the window, even though I briefly toyed with the idea yesterday, nor too lax. Refusing to kiss him in the morning is not sufficient. Perhaps a long-term punishment, like a poisoning. A small dose in his coffee each morning when I've had trouble sleeping because of the closed shutters. Of course, not enough to kill him. The proportionality of the crime and the punishment is the very foundation of justice. But a mild laxative or sleeping pill could do the trick. It's not all so black and white. There are gray areas. For example, I hate when my husband goes to sleep with his back to me, but I don't think that constitutes an offense in and of itself. I don't appreciate it, but it's not against the rules. Although, to be sure, I would have to find out how other couples sleep. This week was particularly intense. I don't think there was a single day without an offense or a punishment. Maxime was, of course, the most serious punishment. I've been flirting with him for months, but I was forced to follow through with it when my husband retracted his nighttime declaration of love. When his words hurt me this much, sleeping with another man is the prescribed punishment. It might seem severe, but it is in fact fair. Denying someone's perception is just as violent as adultery. If my husband had confirmed his I love yous, I never would have slept with Maxime. I would have instead taken advantage of the fake faculty meeting to go shopping. I would not have told my husband. He likes me to dress well, but he finds the activity frivolous. So I update my wardrobe discreetly, though he does sometimes notice, like with the new dress I was wearing on Tuesday night at Louise and Nicolas. With Pierre yesterday, it was different. I completely lost control. Of course, I had to punish my husband for his misconduct with Lucie, but not in that way, not on the spot, not blind with rage. Before reacting, I always take the time to record my husband's transgression in my notebook and wait to punish him until the next day. Rarely do I act the same day. It is essential to take the passion out for the justice system to work. It limits excess. Reacting in the heat of the moment, like I did yesterday, was reckless. This week, I had to inflict other punishments on my husband, including pretend not to hear him when he speaks to me, and move his things, wallet, keys, bag, clothes, important document. These two punishments corresponded to the following two offenses: withdrawing his hand from mine and not putting it back after, and humiliation in front of witnesses, friends, or family. For this last one, I hid his wallet to cost him time as he was leaving for work. Like every day, he had left it on the entryway table. All I had to do was put it in the pocket of the pants he wore the day before. But given the gravity of the triple humiliation at Nicola and Louise's, his unpleasant memories of our first month as young parents, my erasure from the story about the security alarm at his birthday party, and, of course, the Clementine, I also decided to hide his folder containing important work documents. I knew that this way I would not only cost him time, but I would also have to bring the documents to him. I started moving his things years ago, long before the punishment notebook. One morning, I took his keys from his coat pocket while he was in the shower. Another time, I hid in the closet a package he was supposed to take to the post office and that he had left in the entryway so as not to forget it. A few months later, my husband went to see a doctor. It came from good intentions. I had just gone back to work after our daughter was born, and there were entire weeks when my husband and I barely crossed paths. I would leave early in the morning. He would come back late at night. That's when I started to hide his things, so that he would ask me to bring them to him at work. We would meet near his office and have a coffee together before his next meeting. That's what I did on Wednesday with his folder, and I have absolutely no regrets. I created a very nice moment between the two of us. Romantic memories don't fall from the sky. One of us has to fabricate them. Moreover, I like being the one who always knows where things are so I can help him out of compromising situations. It's a constant reminder that he needs me. I started moving my husband's things because I missed him. I continued because he needed to be punished and because he deserved it.